Hello.
Okay, so today.
Today we're talking about serious stuff concerning blood. Now, what we've done so far, I've talked about history, interaction styles. We dived a little bit more into graphical interaction and give you sort of the basic vocabulary of graphical interaction. And then yesterday we dived more into pointing techniques. So one way to look at this past two classes is sort of the lower level part of what makes an interactive systems. But you need to know the basic vocabulary of things in order to be able to design interfaces. Now we're going to start rather from the top down. And in fact, Wendy's class, which we'll talk about interview techniques, we'll talk about even higher level stuff on how you start the design process talking to users. So here I'm going to talk today about the notion essentially of conceptual model, which is the structure that helps you figure out the design of your interactive system. So outline, okay, well, we'll see what comes as we go. So before we start with conceptual model, I want to try to explain why we need conceptual models and why the one I'm teaching is the way it is. Now, if you remember in the very first class, I showed you a diagram of the general conceptual model of an interactive system. Do you remember that diagram?
Which one?
The one. So it had the user, and it had five boxes with arrows. So the user is inputting commands to the system, right? This box that says commands. While you're inputting a command, you may have, there's a return arrow that says feedback, thank you. Say while you're typing, you see the characters that you type, even though the computer is not doing really anything with it. Or while you're dragging an object, you see the object being dragged. This is what we call feedback. And this command is turned into something we call an operation. And that operation deals with the, what we call them, those operations and objects. So that's the hidden part from the user perspective. And then when the system has executed this operation on the internal objects, what does the user get back? No, feedback we already did. You could call it feedback, but the word I used was different. You were there, I remember. Right? Okay, it's called the response. Oh, of course. So you enter commands in the system, you get feedback, so the system tells you what you're doing, and you know what you're doing. Then it does its internal processing with its internal operations and objects, and then you get a response that tells you what happened, essentially, right? Now, so that's going to be the basis for the conceptual model I'll be talking about. Now, before we get into that, the notion of conceptual model was actually, I don't know if it was introduced, but certainly put forward by Don Norman in this book, The Design of Everyday Things. This was a book that was, I think I talked about it a little bit. The original edition was called The Psychology of Everyday Thing, because Don Norman is a psychologist. Then his, for the second or third edition, his publisher said, well, you know, Psychology of Everyday Things, that scares people. So why don't we change the title? And they call it The Design of Everyday Thing. And suddenly it shifted place in the bookstores and became a great success. And I guess we are very happy for Don Norman. He has a very nice house. but it's a very interesting book. Now, the book came out of his personal experience traveling for a sabbatical in Europe. And he decided to go to England rather than other countries in Europe because it was the same language, so it would be easier. But then he soon realizes that even though it's a sort of the same language, but not quite. There are other differences, things you run into every day that makes life harder if you don't know all the codes. And so he has a bunch of examples in this book about how door handles can be misleading, how the layout of washing machines can be really misleading to Americans. And I have the exact opposite experience going on sabbatical in Canada, having been in a house where there was a very strange washing machine that I had never seen and couldn't figure out how it worked. I was looking all around where you pour the liquid, you know, the washing liquid. There is no place to put it. Well, you put it with the laundry. And why not? But you know, if you don't know it, you're not going to find out. And so this is where there's a concept that first he borrowed from James Gibson, the concept of affordance, which I talked about already, but that he later called differently. We'll get to that in a minute. The notion of the use of metaphors in interactive systems sort of came together. And so in this book, there's a lot of this stories about, you know, the fact that the way everyday objects reflect some of the problems we have with the normal interface design, and things that are obvious for one person are going to be completely strange for another. And he provides a set of design, so he introduces the conceptual model and the set of design rules to design interactive systems where we try to avoid these problems that he has identified. So one example is the mapping. Did I talk about that already? No. Okay. So this is a, what do you call this? A stove. I think it's a stove. It's a stove. So it's four heating plates, and then there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 buttons there. And my question to you is, you get to a friend lent you your apartment, or you go to an Airbnb and you find this device, and what do? If you want to heat a bottle of water.
I call a pizza.
You call a pizza, yes. This is not an option.
You test every button to see what it does, to associate every button to every.
Okay.
Button.
And how are you going to know whether it's working or not?
You put your hand on it.
Now, I will tell you, this is a very, very bad idea. And I'll tell you for experience because I did it. So I went to, I was at a friend's, and he had a device with only two of those, and the buttons were like this, horizontal. And one of the button was red, so saying that the thing was hot. And so I approached my hand from one of them, and it felt hot, and so I thought, well, the other one is cold. At which point, stupid thing, I put my hand down on it. It is very painful. Now, if instead you get to a place where there is this stove with this arrangement of heating plates and buttons here, how do you think it's going to work? Yeah. So it's obvious here that unless the engineer who did this was really, really nasty, the mapping is going to be, you know, those four things are going to map to those four things because they have the same layout. Right? Now here, if you look carefully, and I'm surprised that we found that, but if you look carefully, and I know the picture is crappy, but here you have four little diagrams which are actually each one a square divided in four with one white square that shows the mapping from this button to, this one, etc. So you can actually discover the mapping on this device. It's not completely hidden, but it's not natural. So the notion of affordance, as I mentioned briefly when I talked about Gibson, but when I talked about Gibson, it was about invariance and stuff about perception. But Gibson introduces this notion of affordance, which he defines as what the environment offers to the animal. And so he's talking about affordances not only for humans, but for any animal. The idea that the world around us has offers opportunities for action. So if I come into a place and I want to sit down, I will recognize things that are sittable upon. So if I come to this room, I will find chairs, but a table also has, you know, the properties of being sturdy enough, proper height, so I can sit on it. Now, I don't have to come in and measure the table and see, you know, if it's solid. I perceive aspects of this table that tells me, yes, you can sit on it. Now, there was a big misunderstanding of this notion of affordance by, as defined by Gibson, because for Gibson, it's what the environment has to offer. It's not necessarily things that are perceivable. And in fact, a lot of the time we spend learning and growing up as kids is to learn to recognize affordances. How do I know that this table is sturdy enough? You know, if the table were made of cardboard, I would recognize it and I would not sit on it. And maybe the one in cardboard would support my weight, but, you know, I'm not sure. And maybe this one is broken and I can see it and it will collapse. So there is a distinction between what the world has to offer and the actual affordances of the world and what I perceive. But we are extremely good at detecting these affordances. So for example, if you, and this is from a paper that has studied this perception of affordances, you give a person a tube like this, and they will spontaneously discover the various affordances for rolling it, maybe for walking on it if you have good balance, or hiding into it. So for a long time, and due to Don Norman, who used this notion of affordance in his book and brought it to the field of HCI, a lot of people talked about affordances to talk about what the objects in the world show that they are able to do. Now, Don Norman, after a certain many years, decided that indeed what he was talking about was not the same notion as Gibson, and decided, and there's an article and there's a pointer to it that we'll put up on the website, that the affordances that he's talking about should really be called signifiers. And a signifier is a perceived affordance. So in Gibson's notion of affordance, the affordance exists even if it's not perceived, and Norman's signifier is the affordance exists only if it is perceived. If I don't know that something is going to support my weight, for him, there is no signifier, and therefore I will not attempt to do the action, so it's as if it didn't support my weight. So the thing is, you know, we are, through evolution, among other things, our brain, our perceptual systems are made for us to perceive affordances. And a lot of that is used in user interfaces. When we design user interfaces, and the design of the desktop interface by Xerox PARC was meant to convey some of the affordances of the real world by having things like look like a folder, that look like a document, that look like a trash can. You are telling people, well, this should work like a folder, this should work like a trash can. Now, this notion of affordances is, it's one of the things that it's so so much part of ourselves that it's hard to really be aware of it. But according to Gibson, it's really the foundation for our knowledge of the world. And it also means that, which is a very interesting sentence for a cognitivist to say, that much of our everyday knowledge resides in the world, not in the head. Remember that cognitivists tend to think that everything is in the head. And that was, in a sense, the start of a movement in cognitivism that recognized that, you know, it's not all about the brain, but it's also about our senses, about our way of, the way we perceive the environment and the way we act in the environment. And it led, for example, to the concept of distributed cognition by people from UCSD, Jim Holland and others. which says that, you know, we have a lot of, we use the world as an external resource for our knowledge and for our intelligence about the world. Now, as I said, a lot of things we do when we grow up is to learn to recognize affordances. And interestingly, Eleanor Gibson, who was James Gibson's wife, was a developmental psychologist. And she is very famous, not in HCI, unfortunately, but she's very famous for having worked on developmental psychology, having shown evidence of what she calls perceptual learning, that we learn to perceive and we perceive to learn, which is, I think, a wonderful sentence. And she's famous in particular for having come up with this experiment called the visual cliff experiment. If you take a baby of a few months that can crawl, and you put him or her on a table like this, it's very unlikely that it's going to fall. If you're a reasonable mother, you will never try. But very early on, they learn through their experience, not really by falling, but by discovering the world, that if you perceive a visual cliff, that is, that the plane you're on suddenly stops and then there is some emptiness, then you should not go there. And so she did this experiment where she created this device here, which you see has this kind of table. And then there's a baby here. And then she was asking the mother to go on the other side and to call her baby to come to her. Now, the thing that you may not see is that on this part of the device here, there is a glass plate. So, in fact, the baby could perfectly cross and go over there because the environment has this affordance of supporting him. But he has not learned to recognize it. It's not common that, you know, you learn to walk on glass. I remember being at the CN Tower in Toronto. This is a, you know, huge tower. At the top, there is an observatory. And then the part would have a glass floor that is, I don't know, few square meters, and you look down to 200 or 300 meters of emptiness, and you know it's glass, and you know it's that thick, and it, you know, a lot of people just cannot make it. So we have this wariness, and sure enough, you know, the baby, even though it's his mother calling him, say come, they won't cross the visual cliff. So we really have this sort of wired in our brains. So I think it's really important to understand this difference between affordances and signifiers because it allows us to, I think, really understand problems with the usability of a number of systems by looking at the crossing between whether an affordance is here or not and whether a signifier of this affordance is here or not. By the way, this table came from, should have given credit, from a paper by Bill Gaber, who was a student of Don Norman, before they changed the term to signifier. And Bill Gaber has studied the audio of the affordances in the auditory space and created the notion of auditory icons. The idea that when you hear a sound, you don't really hear a sound. And in fact, you know, compared to visual world, we have few words to describe sounds. And when we describe sounds, we often describe them as the sound that something makes. So when you hear a sound, what in fact you hear is the source that produced the sound and the interaction that produced the sound. So, you know, if I tap on this table or if I scratch the surface, the words you're going to use is like a tapping or a scratching because it's the action that you hear. It's not, of course, it's a sound, but your brain instantly turns it into source and interaction. Anyway, getting back to this, so we have situations where an affordance for a particular action may be present or absent, And then a signifier for this affordance may be present or absent. Right? So that gives us four cases here. So there is the good case. The good case, of course, is the affordance is present. The signifier is present. It means you can. There is a system has a particular ability, and you can see it. So it's a perceivable affordance, and all is well. Yes? Example in user interface?
A button.
Yeah. Now, maybe the first time you see a button, you don't recognize it as a button, especially these days where they do this flat material design, as Google calls it, which I think is really terrible. Why would you remove information that our evolution has wired us to recognize? I don't know. But yeah, button is a good example of affordance that is present. Now, if the affordance is present and the signifier is absent, it's called a hidden affordance. It's there, but you don't see it. Okay, so, example. You have to know, you have to learn it, or have to see someone else do something. Say, oh, you could do this. I didn't know.
Resizing the window.
Sorry?
Resizing the window.
Resizing the window.
Shortcuts.
Shortcuts? Yes? The one I like is the icon in the title bar of Windows on the Mac. If you have a document open, the title of the window gives the name of the document. It also has a little icon next to it. Very few people know that you can actually click this icon and drag it, say, to attach a document to your email. Any Mac users here? Yeah, did you know that?
No.
Okay.
It's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. I recommend it. And the funny thing is that it's the same icon that you see in the Finder. But because it's stuck there in the title bar, somehow, you know, it's just there, you know, to be nice. It's not functioning like a normal icon. So that's a perfect example of a hidden affordance. And those are really nasty because, you know, people have to put time and energy putting a functionality in the system, and nobody is going to see it, nobody's going to use it. Now, you have a lot of things with gestural interfaces, and that's a big problem with gesture interfaces, is that they're discoverable. If you don't know the gestures that are possible, the system is not going to give you hints about what you can do. Okay, now if the affordance is absent and the signifier is present, that means you think you can do something, but you can't. So a false affordance. Now, have you run into one of those? You see something, say, I should do that, and it doesn't. Yes? Yes, you?
Sometimes some websites, when you, the design and the style makes you thinking that underlined text is a hyperlink, but it's nothing. And you try to click and there is nothing.
Oh yeah, so text that is styled like a hyperlink, so
blue
and a line underneath looks like a link because we've learned to recognize it as a link. It's a perceptual learning, still at play, but it doesn't work. Yes, you had another one?
As well, sometimes
there are
buttons that are actually
not working,
so you click on them, they say, yeah, you have to click on it, but nothing happens.
Okay, and you think they do it on purpose?
No, maybe they just forget
about it. The thing on the web, sometimes you push on the button and it does something, but it doesn't look like it does, and that's how you buy something three times. Yes.
When we have a dialog on the screen, but say you see the button here,
so yeah, when you have a modal dialog, it's a good point. Suddenly, you know, a bunch of things become dead that used to work, so it looks like it does. One that I find often annoying is that, you know, when you have text that you think should be selectable, but you can't. That happens to me when, you know, your thing comes up with a dialog box with an error, and you don't understand the error. You want to send an email to staff saying what the error was, and can't copy the damn text. So I do a screenshot.
One thing I see a lot in the web is that they format modals and dialogs like windows,
yes,
title bars and stuff, but then you cannot, I've done it myself to try to drag something to see what's behind them, and
yeah,
it doesn't work.
So it's another version of this modal thing that changes the mode, and so Okay? And then the last case here is that if you don't have the affordance and you don't have the signifier, well, so, you know, there's not much to say. It's called correct rejection, and that's fine. So I think this is a very, you know, I mean, it's a very simple grid, but it's really interesting, again, as an analytical tool to look at existing interfaces and to, you know, see what goes into essentially the three cases here, and if they go into the bad ones here, how could you fix this? Now, this leads me to the notion of a mental model, which is the idea that in order to be able to go out about our lives, we need to maintain a mental representation of the world. Now, you know, we still have, there are many theories and models of mental models. And I think, you know, we're really far from really understanding how it works at the neurological level. But the thing that is sure is that we use information from the world, we use our everyday experience, we use stuff we learn explicitly, to create this model of the world that allows us to, in a sense, solve problems all the time. So, you know, every day coming to campus or coming back home is solving a problem, especially if your car is screwed or the buses are on strike or something. And so you have a model in your head of, you know, what is the network of transportation that you can use to go home. And you make plans. And sometimes you have to revise those plans to adjust to the situation at hand. Now, the thing is, typically, when you use a computer system, you also create a mental model of how it works. You have this idea of how the things you see provide some affordances for action, but what does it mean that this is displayed in this way instead of that way? When you do something, your interpretation of what happened according to Norman's action theory is based on the model you have in your head. And so it supports both explanations and predictions. So explanation is what you use in the evaluation phase of the action theory loop, what just happened. Oftentimes, you know, if you don't, if it's a new system, you don't really understand because you haven't yet formed a mental model for it. And then it supports prediction, which is, well, how would I achieve that goal? So it supports planning. Now, there are a number of mental models, objects, actions, state transitions, and I don't have time to go into detail, and it's not really the point here. The point I want to make is that when you create an interface, if you're the designer, you have your own mental model of this interface, and you turn it into what I call a conceptual model. That's going to be the basis for deciding how your system works. What are these commands? What are these objects, these operations, these responses that I had in my little diagram? That's a conceptual model that defines how the system works. Now, a user of that system is spontaneously going to create their own mental model of that system, of how they think it works, based on what they see, what their experience using it is, what they have used before, and maybe what other people are telling them or what they are reading in the documentation. So all of this information, they create their own mental model. Now, when you have a system with usability problem, when people have a hard time doing things or make errors all the time or are frustrated, it is because their mental model clashes with the conceptual model. They had built some model in their head that just doesn't match the conceptual model. So they think it should work that way because for them it's consistent in their head. But that's not the way the designer thought about it. And so it doesn't mean that necessarily the system is poorly designed, but somehow something got missed in terms of who the users of these systems are going to be, what mental model they're likely to form based on their experience and based on what the system is providing. So I think this is a very important notion. It's a notion that we don't know how to really operationalize, so it's not telling you how to identify the problems and how to fix them. But when you see people frustrated, don't think they're stupid. Just think there was a mismatch between the conceptual model and the mental model they form. So then the question becomes, well, how can we design systems to minimize those clashes? How can we make systems where conceptual models better match those of users? Well, the thing is, a lot of things that go into forming a mental model for a new system is based on prior experience. And, you know, you expect, I mean, nowadays in desktop systems, you expect an application to have a file menu. You expect to have, you know, certain capabilities. You expect to be able to copy and paste, right? So if you do a system that's going to be, you know, a lot better, but it's not doing any of this thing, people are going to be surprised. But we also use knowledge from our interaction with the real world. I was mentioning the Xerox Star, which was designed for secretaries, and this is why it was using these notions of files and the folders. And what they did was to use a metaphor of the real world, and it's called the desktop metaphor, to create this interface. Now, a metaphor is in linguistics, it's a figure of speech where you establish a link between two words, but without explicitly comparing them. So, you know, if you say a golden sickle lights the night, you know what a sickle is? A sickle is this tool, the very sharp tool, with the blade being, in fact, the shape of the moon that you can use to harvest things. So if I say a golden sickle lights the night, I haven't made an explicit comparison. I haven't said the moon is like a golden sickle. So the thing is, from the context, because I'm saying lights the night, what lights the night is the moon, so oh, he's talking about the moon. So I established this parallel in my head. So what's powerful with a metaphor is that you transfer relationships and, I should say, also properties of the original object onto the one that you use in the metaphor. And you expect this comparison to be sort of immediate, and you don't need to explain it. So in the desktop metaphor, you know, if you make these icons that are recognized as representing folders, or recognized as representing a trash can or a mail basket, people are instantaneously going to recognize them, make the parallel with physical world, and will spontaneously try to do the similar actions. Now, so here's the desktop metaphor. So it compares objects of the virtual desk with objects of the real desk, and it transfers properties and operations like moving, opening, putting into the trash can, taking out of the trash can maybe, etc. The important thing is that the goal is not to simulate a real desk. And in fact, there was, I think it was in the 90s probably, there was an interface that was created for small devices, what was called PDAs at the time, and it was called the Magic Cap, I think. And they had modeled an interface where you had a street, and you walk in the street, and then you're at your office, and then you get into your office, and then you sit at your desk, and then on your desk there's a phone where you have to turn the old-fashioned phone, you know, where you have to dial, and you have the Rolodex that you have to roll. So they tried to make sort of a literal copy of the physical world. And that was a disaster. Well, first of all, because it was probably too ambitious, but it was uselessly complicated for what they were trying to achieve. So the idea with the metaphor is that you use hints like the shape of the icons telling you it's a file, it's a document, it's a folder, and then some simple operation. But then you want to go beyond the direct copy of what's in the physical world to take advantage of the capabilities that the computer offers to you. So, for example, the fact that you can easily duplicate a digital document, you know, it would be silly to have an icon for a photocopier, for example, because that's additional actions that really don't add to the thing. Yes.
What was the name of that device when you work in the street?
I think it was called Magic Cap, but since you're equipped with Google, you can tell me. I can find it. I find it every year that I forget more of these things, so they should be in the slides. I don't put them in the slides to keep your attention up, but it was magic something for sure. Anyway, so the idea is by using this metaphor, I'm instead of forcing the user to start with sort of a blank mental model, if that exists, I can, you know, instantly initialize it, if you wish, with a bunch of things from previous knowledge. So it saves learning, it capitalizes on external knowledge, and it takes advantage of affordances that we are used to in the real world. And so, as I was saying before, the designer is going to define the conceptual model. Well, that's, I wish it were always the case, because unfortunately, I'm going to tell you something, a lot of systems are, you know, designed sort of like, oh, we're going to do a screen like this and a screen like that, and then you click here and it's going to do that, without really a structured conceptual model behind it. But say you have a good designer who's going to do a proper conceptual model, that conceptual model gets reflected in what Don Norman calls a system image. What he means by this is not just the software that you run, but it's also the documentation or the help that comes with it. So it's everything that the user can see about the system is called the system image. And then the system image, the user uses the system, and through interaction with that system, he or she creates a mental model for that system. And the challenge is to have the mental model match the conceptual model, even though these two people have not necessarily ever met each other. So the reason why in Wendy's class, for example, you'll have all these exercises that have you learn more about users, really the end goal is this, is if you know your users better, you can better predict what their mental models will be, and you can reduce the cases where there will be this this clash between the systems model, the conceptual model, and the mental model. Okay, how is that for now? Yes? So, what is this about? So, well, I guess this is what I just said. How the designer wants to the user to see the system, the conceptual model. So, the conceptual model, it's not a functional requirements or the. It's not a design document in the sense that computer scientists are used to think of design documents. This is at the higher level. And essentially, it's user-oriented. It must refer to things that the user will see and manipulate. Then you go to the design of the system in terms of in computer terms, and then you can go into what's under the hood. But at this level, we want to talk about what are the things that the user will see, what will the screen look like, what commands are available, what kind of response you're getting, etc. And so that will define the system image, and the mental model is created
This is what I just said. So.
So metaphors can help make better conceptual models. Doesn't mean you have to use a metaphor. You can also use a metaphor poorly, so you know it's not a guaranteed success. If you think in terms of these affordances and signifiers, I should say, and this table we had before, you can also reduce the risk that people will misunderstand the system or will miss important functions of the system that are hidden. And what a lot of people have done is to convert these very high-level things into much concrete guidelines. So design guidelines, design rules, you know, human interface guidelines is what Apple calls them. Now, I don't teach about these because, you know, I think they're pretty boring. So you can look at them and understand what they're about. They're going to tell you, well, you know, if you are going to do this type of task or feature, you know, we have this type of interaction. And it's essentially about doing things in a consistent way based on the vocabulary of interactions that the particular platform is providing. So a lot of people in introductory HCI classes talk about these. I find them boring myself. I think it's important to understand why they are there. And like every guideline, you know, what you learn as you go is not just how to use them, but how not to use them when you need to break the rules for good reasons. And that's what good design is about, is, you know, having guidelines and following them when it's relevant, but also breaking them when there is a good reason. And so when you see people making errors, when you see people being frustrated, when you see people misusing the system or not using the system and doing the task with other things, when you see lower productivity, this is a sign of poor design of the system. Now, poor design can have big consequences. That's what I call the chaotic nature of design. Now, this was a ballot to vote in the American election of, was that 2000? The Bush-Gore election? Remember that? No, you were kids. So, in this election, there was a very tight count in Florida, and the outcome of Florida was going to decide on the outcome of the election for the entire country because of the way the American electoral system works. You know, each state elects some, what are they called?
Electoral college.
So number of votes, and depending on the majority of votes in each state, the electoral college is going to vote for the person with the majority vote in that state, and then you add the electoral college votes, and the winner is the one with the highest number of points. Now, long story short, it turned out in that particular election, Florida was going to be deciding for the result. To vote in that election, in fact, each state and each county can decide on what the ballots look like. Which to a French person is like mind-boggling. I mean, in France, we have one piece of paper per candidate. It's hard to make a mistake, really, right? Now here, the way they vote is you have everybody on one piece of paper. You slide this piece of paper in a kind of mechanical machine. So there is this ruler on top with holes. And then you attach to the device, there is a pencil kind of device. And you punch a hole in front of your candidate. This is known as the butterfly ballot of Palm Beach County, which acquired large celebrity at the time. Now, imagine that so we have Bush here, we have Gore here, so Republican, Democrat, we have Pat Buchanan here, who's, it's like right. And then you have a bunch of others, candidates. What happened is that in this county is Al Gore should have won, according to the demographics. It turned out that Pat Buchanan got an amazing number of votes. Can you see why? Of course, you've seen the picture. The thing is, you know, well, remember, we're in Florida. There's a bunch of older people there. And maybe, you know, they don't pay attention. But if you want to vote for Al Gore, you look at the thing, you read left to right. Okay, so we have Bush is the first, Gore is the second. I want to vote for Gore, so I can 1, 2, and I punch this hole. Except I voted for Pat Buchanan. So, you know, whose fault is it?
Designer.
What?
The designer.
Maybe it was on purpose.
Maybe it was on purpose. I think they had more candidates than usual. So, you know, there are interesting design constraints here, given the shape of the ballot and the machines they're using. But yeah, I mean, there is obviously a design problem in that it's not clear enough the mapping between the candidates and the holes.
Did someone have the arrows afterwards, or were they initially the arrows on the which are pointing?
No, the arrows are here, and as you can see, you know, depending on how you slide it in, it's not really very well aligned. So I mean, there's all sorts of issues. Now that ended up in a big controversy and all that, but. Now here's a nice critical example. So imagine you buy a fridge that has a freezer compartment, and it comes with this sticker next to the settings. So you have two settings here. One is A, B, C, D, E. The other is 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. And it tells you, well, normal setting is going to be C and 5, so in the middle. Then if you want fresh food in the fridge colder, you are going to move this to the left. If you really want it cold, you're going to move to B, and then even further to the left here. If you want the freezer to be colder, you're going to move to D, but keep this to the left, and etc. And so the question is, well, what do you think is the underlying conceptual model? Another way is, what is the mental model you form based on this description? First thing you regret buying that fridge. Yes?
Well, my main problem would be that you shouldn't have to change two things to get into the temperature of the fridge. That's quite terrible.
So, it is misleading, but the thing is, you bought a fridge with a freezer, and a lot of people are going to think, well, you know, there's a setting for the fridge and a setting for the freezer, except when you look at the thing, it doesn't quite look like that, but it still looks more like if you're changing the numbers, it's going to affect more the fridge, and if you change the letters, it's affecting more of the freezer. And so it's not unlikely that the mental model you're going to form, since you don't really understand it, you try to simplify and say, well, you know, it looks like this could work. But in fact, it's a cheap fridge. And in a cheap fridge, you don't have two compressors. You have only one compressor. And so what's happening is you have one setting, the ABCD, which is controlling how much cold the compressor is delivering. And then the number one is deciding how this gets separated between the fridge and the freezer. And even when you know that, it's like, oh God, I'm going to. Now, this is very similar, if you think of it, of a number of showers. You know, because there are many showers where you control the amount of water, and then you control the temperature. Now in that case, that works fine because that's the variables you want to control. The showers where you control the amount of cold water, amounts of hot water, are a lot more messy to adjust, right? So this is something that Don Norman talks a lot about in his book, is this notion of variables. What are the meaningful variables for the user? You know, for a fridge, I want to think of how cold is the fridge, how cold is the freezer. For a shower, I want to control amount of water and temperature of water. And then, and that's the mapping you were implicitly mentioning, is you want to map these physical variables that you relate to direct controls on the system. Now, of course, you could have one compressor and this thing and still create an interface on top that would make you look like you control the two things independently by doing the mapping internally rather than requiring the user to do it themselves. Okay, so so this notion of mapping is one of the important principles from Don Norman. Now, as I said before, you have tons of books, papers, documents, volumes about all these design rules to design better interfaces. I know there's a book with 800 ergonomic rules. The nice thing with that one is I'm sure for every rule in there, you can find another one that says something the opposite or inconsistent with it. But so I like the ones, the two I show, because on the contrary, they try to have fewer rules, but they're more generic, more powerful. So Norman has three rules. One is make things visible, which, of course, you can map to the first principle of direct manipulation. The idea there is you want this user to be able to know the state of the system by looking at what's on the screen. Of course, in practice, the state of the system can be very complex, so it's not going to be that simple. But that means that you have to imagine according to what the user is trying to do at some point in time, in some mode, or in some state of the interface, what is relevant to the user at that point, and make that information available. The second one is the mapping principles, where you want to help users understand the mappings between their actions and their effects, their results, the controls that you put on the displays and their effects and the internal state of the system, and the state of the system and what you see of that state. And if you do these mappings in the right way, you can have an interface that is, in general, in fact, simpler and much more effective. And then there's a feedback principle, which is about informing the user. Users, you know, they don't know what's going on in the computer. And again, they're not you. They cannot make inferences about, you know, oh, I click on this thing on this website and nothing is happening. It means that there is an HTTP request that is going through some firewall and going to my bank and going to this and that. And it's normal that nothing is happening. People don't think like that. If they click a button, they want the button to react. Another list I have here, which is from Ben Schneiderman, is a little bit more detailed, but essentially it's a bit more operationalized as well. But it's similar. Thrive for consistency, because if things are consistent, people will learn them more easily since they already know them. They're also more likely to try things out. Like, you know, if two things work like then this other software, maybe this other thing works the same, and people will be more likely to discover things. You want to support expert users with things like shortcuts that may take longer to learn, but expert users are ready to do this kind of thing. Provide feedback, we talked about that. Have design dialogues with closers, where you know when you're done providing information to the system. Prevent errors and help repair them. A classic example, which is gone now, but a long time ago, on the Macintosh operating system, if you tried to delete something, if you tried to copy something and there was not enough space, it would tell you there is not enough space. But it would tell you if you empty the trash, you will have enough space to copy the document.
Yes,
I'm done. And so, you know, it's one thing to detect the error, it's another to provide the user with help to repair it. Reversible operation that comes from direct manipulation, control to the user as well to a certain sense, and reduce short-term cognitive load. It maps to the idea that you put stuff on the screen so people don't have to remember what they've done together and don't have to guess what system, what state the system is in, but can sort of read it somewhere on the screen. Okay, we're going to stop here because Wendy is here and I have to make a phone call. And you have it waiting to, since I have the other page, so I'm going to...